If you're a caregiver or you know a caregiver who is struggling to get their kids to eat, not knowing why their kids aren't eating, why are they picky eaters? Is this normal behavior? Is it possibly eating disorder? Then you're going to want to send them this podcast, because today I interviewed Dr. Anita Federici. She's a clinical psychologist and the owner of Center for Psychology and Emotional Regulation. She's given talks all over the world about eating and eating disorders, and it's not what you think. There's so many myths. So if you're looking to get excellent insight from somebody who absolutely knows and lives eating disorders, then you're going to want to listen to this interview.
Welcome to the FASD Success Show, the only podcast where you can get real-world information about fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. This show will help you create calm in the chaos, have hope for the future, and more importantly, save your sanity so you don't lose your flipping mind. Now, here's your host, caregiver turned world FASD educator, Jeff Noble.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to episode 68 of the FASD Success Show. I'm your host, Jeff Noble. This is the podcast that is all about FASD success. It is all about making sure individuals on the spectrum are successful, making sure caregivers to those individuals on the spectrum are successful. Basically, anybody who is in the realm of an individual with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, we want to make the lives better. We want to make everybody's lives better. And how do we do that? We do that by talking to some people who are doing absolutely amazing work that could give us insight and knowledge that we might not have been able to get anywhere else, or just to make it make sense, because FASD is a complex disability, and so anytime we can have somebody come on and make it make sense to us, well, once we know better, we could do better. And my guest today is awesome. She is going to drop a lot of knowledge bombs. She is absolutely going to give you some insight that you've never thought about when it comes to FASD and eating disorders. And it's not all negative. It's like, where do we go from here? How do we support? What needs to happen? And then we also talk about this excellent new therapy that's coming out. It's not new in terms of date, but it's new in terms of its use with fetal alcohol. So we're going to get an introduction to DBT therapy. Before we do that, I just want to say thank you. And I'm saying thank you because literally this weekend it really hit me that this podcast, this show, the FASD Success Show, is a thing. Like, and it's not like it wasn't important before or I didn't realize the impact, but it is growing. It is growing. We have well over 1,000, listeners per episode, for the week while it airs. I think the last time I checked, we had close to 88,000 people that have downloaded it during the time, and we're episode 68. It's absolutely mind-blowing. So it kind of just sunk in on the weekend, and I'm like, okay, this is working. We've got something here, and we always want to make it better, and we always want to do cool things, and we always want to evolve it. And I love community, and I love connecting with people, and I get a chance to do that with the families that I work with. But I also want to connect with you guys more. I also want to connect with you, the podcast listener, the listener to this show. I want to create a community. So we've been coming up with some excellent things that we could do and ways that we could do that. And I want you to be a part of it. And I just I'm sitting here and I'm talking into a microphone. But I really, what I get a pleasure is jamming with you guys. I get a pleasure out of emailing back and forth and doing all that good stuff. So myself and Yvonne, who is my external support specialist, because we don't use the word assistant, and she's also the producer, because she got Anita to come on the show. She was the one who reached out to me and said Dr. Federici would make a very awesome guest, and she sure did. But anyways, I digress. So we're going to be doing more, and I want to create more of a community. And I have also some info for you at the end of the show as well, just about feedback, because I get people that email me and that message me and say, Jeff, how can we support the show? And before I was just like, hey, just listen and just share the show. But you could do more now. And there's some cool things that I'm going to share. But I'm going to share that at the end of the show, okay? So stick around. If you are like that end of show crew who listens to the full thing, this is going to be right up your alley. And I'm super excited about it, okay? But enough of that. I will end with this. If you like the show, we'd love to have you subscribe to the show. It really helps us, and it helps other people. Why does it help other people? Because the larger the audience the show is, the more subscribers, the more that tells Apple and Google and Spotify that we're a relevant show. And so when people are looking for FASD information, they see our show, right? Our show comes up, and it makes people happy, and people join us. And so by you subscribing, we're growing the audience, and we're helping others. That's what this is all about. And I'm going to help you today. We're going to learn about eating disorders. We're going to learn about FASD and eating disorders and how that intersects with the both of those. And then we're going to talk about DBT. And who are we talking about this with? Let me tell you. Let me run down this bio real quick because, again, Yvonne, what a great get. Thanks for getting Dr. Federici. She was cool. I was a little bit nervous, but we got it sorted out. So let me tell you who this is. Dr. Anita Federici is a clinical psychologist and the owner of the Center for Psychology and Emotional Regulation. She holds an adjunct faculty position at York University and is a distinguished fellow of the Academy for Eating Disorders. Dr. Federici is a recognized authority on eating disorder treatment and dialectical behavior therapy. Dr. Federici also serves as an elected co-chair for the Suicide and DBT Special Interest Group for the Academy of Eating Disorders in 2019. She was awarded Businesswoman of the Year by the Meridian Women of Excellence Committee for her outstanding contributions to the community and to the province. I am ready. I will be back after the interview, and we're going to go over some amazing points she made. So if you're ready, I'm ready. All right, let's go. All right, everybody, here I am with Dr. Anita Federici. Doctor, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can I call you Anita?
Absolutely.
Okay. That you do. Like your designation, your doctor designation, you work hard, and I don't want to take that away from you, but if I say your full name, I'll be here forever. I'm going to screw it up. I got your last name right once, correct?
You did. That was impressive.
Got to go out on top. And you also didn't know when I watched your webinar, I listened to you say it 5 or 6 times. Anyway, insider secrets here. It is a pleasure. This is something, FASD and eating disorders in general, are it's a comorbidity. Dr. Popova's work, who's very famous in the FASD world, found that there's over 428 co-concurring disorders with FASD. And from listening to you, it makes sense why eating disorders are one of them. So I want to just educate and then talk best practices, because that's what I'm all about here on the show. It's called FASD Success. So we want to arm the caregivers with the best knowledge possible. Cool?
Awesome.
Okay.
Great.
Okay. You're awesome. Now, but it's my first time really meeting you. So I'd love to get to know you. And I always ask about an origin story. And so you have a practice and you give lectures and talks and all over the place. With eating disorders, like, how did you come into this path?
It's a journey, as it is with any of us, right? I worked for a long time, even as a teenager, I was always fascinated with women's issues and things like that. But I got to tell you something. I didn't go to university until I was in my mid to late 20s, because I didn't think I was smart enough. So I really spent a lot of time sort of trying to figure myself out. And when I did go back to university, I really fell in love with these sort of working with underserved, misunderstood people.
But what was that draw? Was there an experience or was there just a perception? Do you remember if there was something that changed you and said, I could serve this population?
I think it was a combination of things. I think I've had my own experiences struggling with body image and eating disorders and knowing that there was no treatment. There was no, I'm going back 30 years at this point. It's in my family. And I was fortunate that when I got into my master's degree, I was accepted to work at the Toronto General Hospital in their eating disorders program. And that was it. I knew that I had found something that I was passionate about, that I could make a difference in. And I have never stopped. I've never turned around from that because the need is so massive.
You're saying people don't look sick, like eating disorder doesn't have a certain look. And it's the same with fetal alcohol. 90% don't have the face. They look normal, talk normal.
Yep.
So they're perceived as functioning. And you're saying the same with eating disorders, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's this misconception, you know, if you were to poll 100 people on the street right now and you said, what does an eating disorder look like? Or how would you know? Most people are going to talk about being too thin. They're going to think about anorexia. And the majority of people that have an eating disorder, just like you said, with FASD, the majority are average weight or above average weight. There is no look. And so this is one of the reasons why so many people are misunderstood and misdiagnosed or underdiagnosed, because they don't look like they're underfunctioning or they're unwell.
Oh my gosh. I'm telling you, you could just change eating disorder and FASD like that. Literally, if I just changed the words, that's something I would say to other people when trying to explain it. And now with FASD, you know, it is a comorbidity. The majority of the people that listen to this are caregivers, so I want to make sure we also arm them as well. We know COVID has just increased everything. And I like what you said. You called eating disorders in COVID the perfect storm. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, if the first thing that I would say is that we in the field of eating disorders, there was a crisis before COVID, and now with COVID, it is at a level of severity that I've never seen in 25 years. So the perfect storm, meaning that eating disorders thrive in isolation, for one, like many mental health, physical health conditions, right? People who were able to access treatment in various settings have not been able to do that because there are stay-at-home orders, or a lot of our eating disorder programs had to shut down for periods of time because they couldn't offer in-person services. Many still are operating at one-third or a half of the capacity. So you have isolation. You have so for the caregivers listening who do support a loved one, let's say with an eating disorder, now there's more pressure on the caregivers to try to feed their children in the absence of a whole lot of support. That's very hard to do when somebody has an eating disorder and is emotionally dysregulated. In addition, if they have, FASD, et cetera. Yeah. So parents, caregivers are burning out. They're saying, I can't do this anymore. They're trying to work or their businesses have folded. I mean, it's just very difficult. You also have an increased use of social media. So we know that as social media use increases, especially in our younger kids, teenagers, et cetera, two things also increase: body image dissatisfaction and distortion. So the more you look at social media, the worse you feel about your body. Mm-hmm. Two, emotion dysregulation increases. So the more time you spend on the screen, the less emotionally regulated you are.
Yeah, that's...
So we have a number of these co-occurring phenomena.
So I want to get into that because here's what you said. Executive functioning. You went E because when I see ED. So eating disorders are associated with anxiety and depression. Well, guess what? Yeah. What do we know about individuals on the spectrum? That 90% of individuals have mental health issues because of deficits in their affect regulation. So 90%. And what is the 90%? It's either anxiety or depression or both. So we talk about the perfect storm. 90% of individuals are going to deal with anxiety or depression. That's just one. Two, you talked about increased stress could be a trigger. We know folks on the spectrum have sensitive HPAs, hypothalamus, pituitary, adrenal axis. It's your stress response. So just those two things, it's alone, just like,
yeah.
it's such a high percentage.
Well, and this, it's so fascinating, right? The HPA sort of piece, because people with, there's not everybody, but there's large subgroups of people with eating disorders who are extraordinarily sensitive to stress, to stimuli, right? And so, you know, COVID exacerbates an already unsettled biology. And so people then turn to maladaptive ways of coping, whether they mean to or not. And eating, we can talk a little bit more about that. Eating's one of those behaviors that ironically can soothe an unsettled biology. And so that's where this overlap between, let's say, FASD and eating disorders, et cetera, come in.
So they're so intertwined because it's biologically based. Yes. So we know FASD is like, in a nutshell, it is prenatal trauma, you know, and we also know postnatal trauma, more adverse effects, sensitive HPA. So individuals on the spectrum not only have more adverse effects, but they also have a tough time handling them, right? Because they go from 0 to 100. You talk about emotional regulation. They get caught in their, they get caught in the limbic system so much. So they're constantly in their fight or flight because they can't manage their arousal. They can't manage the stimulus. They can't manage their thoughts. And so they can't get access to their executive functioning, which regulates, which would probably. So is eating in the limbic system because it's like a survival? How biologically, how does that work?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the regulation of hunger, fullness, appetite, all of that resides largely in the limbic system. So we know that certain eating disorders like anorexia or ARFID, which is something we can talk about, that there are deficits in the limbic system, and there are abnormalities in the metabolic system. So you have these two systems where genetically, biologically, people are primed to struggle with eating and feeding. So what comes naturally to many people, you know, feeling hungry so you eat, stopping when you're full, knowing when to eat, these things are literal skill deficits that reside in brain differences. So this is not something that one chooses. Eating disorders are not something somebody gets to choose.
What you said was spot on. It's the inability. Not that they don't want to.
Exactly.
We say this
has nothing to do with,
as FASD, it's the inability to adapt and function as expected across the lifespan.
And people miss that. They miss it, I'm sure, in both areas. But they assume, even in many treatment settings, doctors assume like, okay, just eat already. Just enough with this sort of fad or this kind of behavior. And it's an inability. And in fact, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, actually changed that in the eating disorder language. They used to say, when I was trained, they used to say, oh, it's a refusal. It's a refusal. This person is refusing to eat, until they realized that this isn't refusal. It's inability.
Inability. And here, I don't know if you can still see, I have this from the National Institute of Health about FASD and eating disorders. And so what they found was that the individuals on the spectrum had a delayed acquisition of self-feeding behavior. Why am I saying this? Yeah. Because I'll get back on the rails here. And I think this ties in, and we could go back up. But what I wanted to talk about is just, what is your definition of an eating disorder, so the folks have a base of where we're starting from?
Well, and the term eating disorder is really an umbrella term to describe a number of subcategories. But an eating disorder, no matter which one it is characterized by the inability to properly feed oneself for one reason or another. So it doesn't matter whether you're talking about binge eating or restrictive eating because of texture and sensation. The person struggles with an inability to properly feed oneself. And so so there's that piece, but there's also other temperamental traits that we see in people that have eating disorders. So some are very emotionally over-controlled. So you have one category that they're very rigid. very, very inflexible cognitively, like very hard to get them to shift.
Sure. Yes. So they're not very good at transitioning. When the plan changes, it's a meltdown. Yeah. That's a primary characteristic of FASD as well.
Exactly. And I'm glad that you're making that link, because that is one of the, it's fascinating, because there's a whole literature around the overlap between eating disorders and FASD, autism spectrum, and this sort of questioning about shared etiology or shared origins, because there's in a large group of people with eating disorders, there are incredible, sensory issues, to not just to feeding, but to sound, to texture, to touch, to, sometimes they don't like to hear the sound of people chewing, very, very acute sensitivity sent from a sensory perspective, rigidity, as I was saying. So some of them really have a hard time shifting, right? That mental inflexibility, and really like almost a, some of them are sort of, struggle with emotional, almost flatness. Like it's hard for them to express emotion, identify emotion. They don't really know what they're feeling. So you have a whole group that is struggling. They're risk averse. They're socially isolated. And they don't sort of fit in. They don't really fit in with mainstream. And then you have another subgroup who is sort of emotionally under control. They're more dramatic, explosive, impulsive. It's hard to contain them, right? So you've got this kind of, they're either over-controlled and really rigid and like things to be, and they might be more obsessive or compulsive, perfectionistic. It can be really hard to relate to them at times. Versus others who are chaotic.
Yeah, impulse issues. That is a self-regulation, emotional regulation issue to manage one impulses. So here's what you said. Biology loads the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. Is that the saying?
Pulls the trigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was like, wow, geez. I love a good soundbite, by the way. And so that was a pretty sweet one. So it's the inability to feed oneself, and that looks different in different capacities.
It can. I mean, the classic eating disorder presentation also the person will also struggle with a fear of gaining weight or becoming fat like that. So there might be that. Their self-esteem is linked to their body shape and weight. However, there's another group, an avoidant and restrictive food intake disorder. We call it ARFID for short, because no one wants to say all of that every single time. Yeah. And those folks are most closely resemble sort of autism spectrum, things like that. They really struggle with texture, fear of choking, they avoid. And what happens is they're malnourished. They're underweight, not because they're afraid of gaining weight. So they get missed. People go, it can't be an eating disorder because they're not afraid of gaining weight. Nah, they're afraid of eating or the texture or the taste or the color. And they're very, very routine oriented. And so what happens is they don't eat enough. And so, usually this develops early on.
So, yeah. Is that also what you talked about? Because I know some of my families, when they don't want to eat with the family, right? Like, and then they pass it off as a typical teenager just wants to be in their own room.
Yeah.
So
it could be, but this is where a good assessment comes in.
Yeah.
It could be. So that's one of the things we get, right? Like,
I love
it. Yeah. You have to look at, a good assessment, because this is what happens is people don't get the good assessments that they deserve. They get sort of quick meetings with somebody. And depending on what lens you're coming from, you're going to see that person through that lens. If you're not looking at the big picture, you can get lost, seeing the forest through the trees. Like you might not be able to make it out, but people need to have a good assessment. But I do ask caregivers to pay attention to behaviors around food and intake and eating, and are they eating with people? Can they eat with people? Are they losing weight? What's going on with their relationship with food and body?
They might not have the ability to feel satiated.
That's right.
I had a young man that I worked with. He literally could chug a 2 liter of Coke and then not feel like it's even in his belly, and he wants like more. And you're like, dude, you just smashed all this. And it's like you couldn't fill him up.
And that's brain based. Right. That's because the brain, and this is what the latest genetic research is telling us, which is fascinating. And it makes total sense, which is that there are abnormalities in the way the metabolic system works. So feeling full may not happen for some people, or it may take a delayed, you know, where you and I might have a meal and within 10 minutes we go, oh, okay, that's good.
Yeah.
It might take their brain to catch up, an hour later they go, and then they're uncomfortably full because they overdid it. So you could see that, but yeah.
No, for sure. Yeah. And I know I'm going all over the place here, but I just wanted to talk about some more myths. And by the way, you're doing awesome.
Yes.
You're
so
doing
far so good.
Oh, buddy, you're killing it. Okay. So people think that dieting isn't a serious behavior, especially in teenagers.
Yeah. It's one of the most, it's the strongest predictor of eating disorders that we have, one of the strongest predictors. We do not want our kids dieting, period. Right? It's one of the most toxic things that they can do. So diet culture is really damaging because it, you know, we know that we've got kids as young as 6 years old who are self-harming because they think they're fat. 6 years old, six, seven, eight. And, you know, and this is one of the things when I say, why is COVID the perfect storm? You know, I have patients right now on various TikTok platforms or, you know, social media accounts who are just being fed misinformation about food and eating and what your body should be looking like. So dieting is a serious behavior that we should be paying attention to and discouraging our kids from doing.
Another one, mostly girls get eating disorders. You know, I know from when growing up, the stigma was either anorexia or bulimia, and it was girls. And that's a big myth.
No, it is a big myth. And part of that is, you know, your cultural influence. So a lot of boys or men don't want to present and say, oh, I have an eating disorder. Or when they would, like, geez. You know, Jeff, when I worked at Toronto General and another hospitals, you know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, you might have one, you know, male in a sea of, you know, 10 or 12 women. And that's pretty hard to feel like there's a space for you. So doctors often dismiss it. So when boys or men present with symptoms of an eating disorder, it's almost always missed. But if a female, if a girl presents with the same symptoms, they're more likely to inquire about an eating disorder. But we are seeing this across cultures, across sexual and gender orientations. It's a major issue.
Yeah, because you told that story about that gentleman that went into your clinic and that he was fasting. Right. And then you
intermittent fasting,
and then you, which is going, it's like one of the fads basically. Right. Yeah. And then they see some Instagram post or they see an athlete who's just ripped, who doesn't realize that they have a cook and a dietitian and a nutritionist and probably is still not very healthy themselves, but they look this way and they're in a predominant position. And so they assume that's the way. But then what you said was by fasting, it actually reduces functioning, like brain functioning. Can you explain that
exactly.
a little bit?
Yeah. So eating disorder or not, any type of restrictive patterns, intermittent fasting or dieting behaviors, has the same impact on the brain, which is that one, it actually leads to emotion dysregulation. So I always tell clients, you can't have an eating disorder and be emotionally regulated. Those two things are never going to land together. I don't know anybody with a restrictive food intake who's also emotionally regulated. So the brain doesn't respond well to underfeeding. Okay. It doesn't like that. it also, the longer malnourishment goes on, the more damage to the brain. That's why we want to get people treatment and refeeding as soon as possible, because we see damage to the brain, some of which can be reversed with refeeding and some of which is not.
Yeah. So it makes it doubly hard. Yeah. There's my science word, doubly hard for individuals on the spectrum who already struggle from executive functioning and neocortex deficits already.
That's right.
Right. And
this is going to exacerbate all of that.
See, because the goal with individuals on the spectrum is to have interventions to increase functioning, because you'll never reverse what's happened, because it happened during development organically, but we can still increase functioning. And so even eating can help that. And the reverse, not eating well, malnourishment can affect, I'm sure, both the white and gray matter. I'm sure if we look that up, right?
You've got it. You've got it. Exactly. And when there's damage to the prefrontal cortex, the gray and white matter, what ends up happening is that the emotional, the limbic system, becomes more dominant. So behaviors become more and more emotionally based and sort of out of control.
Where we hear about the rages and that, because they're going fight or flight, because they can't
regulate. They're in survival mode.
To use their executive functioning, to use their self-soothing strategies, right? And so this compounds it, and so that's why it is so it is so important. But there's also, let's not forget, there's physical signs and symptoms. Can you tell my audience about some of those?
So signs and symptoms of eating disorders range. Some of the common ones are, you know, changes in weight. So we always say to caregivers, any significant changes in weight loss, weight gain should be investigated for the presence of an eating disorder. So that's one tip I like to give people. Uh-huh. A lot of clients will come to the doctor with stomach problems. They'll have, you know, they'll think that they might have, you know, maybe I have a gluten intolerance. Maybe, you know, there's something wrong with my stomach. If you think about it, the stomach, if you think about your sort of GI tract, gastrointestinal, it's like a muscle. If you're not using it, you lose it, right? So if I'm not eating enough, the natural processes of the GI system to move food down for the muscles to be working, right? It's like any muscle. If I'm not eating enough, my GI tract gets slow. It doesn't work as well. It's not very efficient. And then people have constipation, bloating, sometimes, you know, what looks like IBS may not be IBS. It may actually be secondary to an eating disorder. Jeez. You know, so it's something to look at and think about. But we look at a constellation. So when I first meet somebody, I'm looking at everything from what are they actually eating and drinking. Remember, it's not just food restriction. It could be fluid restriction. Very dangerous. Okay, so we can talk about that, but fatigue. So you've got a young kid who should have lots of energy, who's not, right? So there's a lot of fatigue. Dizziness or fainting needs to be investigated. So when you don't eat enough, for whatever reason, eating disorder or not, if there's, the body goes into starvation mode. Starvation mode is designed to keep you alive, but starvation mode means that your heart rate slows down and your blood pressure might drop. And you might have a really slow resting heart rate. And that can be dangerous. You can go into cardiac arrest. It's one of the reasons why eating disorders have the highest mortality rate than any other psychiatric illness.
Wow.
So it's, you know, so dizziness, fainting, you know, for women or girls, menstrual changes, cold, feeling cold all the time. They can never get warm. Some of our clients grow like a fine hair, like babies,
the white, baby's neck and stuff,
that downy.
Yeah.
That's starvation mode. That's the body being really sophisticated. The body is saying, hey, I'm not getting enough. I'm going to produce things like, I'm going to slow down the heart rate. Let's get some hair on the body. Let's try to warm up the organs so that you can keep going. Poor immune functioning, so that you're not responding well to things, those sorts of things. Yeah.
Here's what I know. My parents have trouble getting our kids to eat. I'm sure that's in general, but like kids to eat healthy, our kids sort of to gravitate yeah. towards the salty, you know, the sugary, stuff like that. Is that still considered a disorder as well? Like if it's an affinity for that?
No, I don't want to overly pathologize. Like there's this fine line, right? You know, I've got a 9-year-old and, you know, she goes through these periods of being a pretty picky eater sometimes. And you know, my eating disorder sort of training, I think, oh, geez, is this something, yeah. right? You know, so I, you know, look, kids have go in phases. It's not abnormal for them to like, who wouldn't want to crave, you know, have the cake or some sugary foods. So you don't want to be too restrictive. Like it, you need them to get exposed to things so they learn how to control themselves around food, et cetera. So, however, I think if you're noticing, if they're having trouble eating and it's leading to problems with weight, normal weight gain, they're not meeting their developmental milestones. They're so anxious about eating, maybe in front of other people, they stop going out. I mean, it's COVID, so this is a little bit trickier right now. The eating, if it starts to impact their functioning, then you might have an eating disorder on your hands or something that I would want you to investigate.
Yeah.
So I would tell parents, keep an eye on it. I mean, a lot of times they move in and out of these sort of phases and that's okay.
This also,
but you want to watch for particular rituals around eating.
Yeah. This also sort of slides into the things you talked about, the perfect storm with kids, and, you know, individuals on the spectrum, but then caregivers also have to watch out for this stuff themselves too. Right, Anita? Like the perfect form for them to develop.
You have to.
Because look at, we talk about co-concurring disorders. You know, caregiver gets, can get caregiver PTSD, caregiver can get anxiety. It's almost like these comorbidities are comorbid with their kids as well as the caregiver.
Yeah. It's the system you're working with, you know, because when you've got a child, when you adult or teen or who's not well, it's going to take a toll on the system. It's going to take a toll on the family. So one of the big things that we do from an eating disorder and DBT perspective is we work with the family. They need support. They need to figure out, am I okay? How am I regulating my emotion? Do I have, you know, compassion fatigue? Do I have depression? You know, and this is where COVID has really exacerbated things. Like at least, you know, I have parents that say to me, at least I could get out of the house, go to work, laugh with my friends, pick up the kids after school. And I got a bit of a break. Now I'm not seeing my friends. I work from home. My kids are both at home. They're trying to do virtual learning, but that's a disaster. There is no break. My home is is everything. And so people are just struggling. Yeah.
It's like you're going through that yourself, Anita. You just rhyme that off. You just rhyme that off so, so well. And before we go into, because you mentioned DBT and I'm very green at that. And so I definitely want to jump in because my parents have actually been asking. I want to talk about two things. One is, how is it related to self-injury? Self-injury is big in our mm-hmm. area, and we know that's, it can stem from a lot of things neurologically, and being anxious, and there's a whole self-soothing. How is self-injury in relation to eating disorder?
If
a parent sees self-harm, and they might uh-huh. this is another now another question they could possibly ask their physician.
So self-injury almost always co-occurs with other things. I don't know that I've ever seen it where somebody is just self-injuring and there's no PTSD or, you know, FASD, eating disorders, et cetera. So when you see self-injury, you want a good assessment if you can, a comprehensive one. How are they related? There's a significant degree of overlap. And the leading theory is that you've got a person, as you've just laid out, there are biological sensitivities, biological contributions. So you've got a person that can't regulate themselves very well. And so So what's happening is that because they can't regulate their emotions, their thoughts, their feelings, you look for, even without realizing it, you look for other ways to self-soothe. Right. You look for other ways to get your needs met. Mm-hmm. So when people come into a clinic like mine, that, you know, they're binging, they're purging, they're self-harming, they're suicidal, they're depressed, there's trauma. And we often say to people, those symptoms, your substance use, your eating disorder behaviors, that's actually not the problem. That's how you're trying to solve the problem. The problem is like the part of the iceberg that you don't see because it's underneath the water, mm-hmm. right? The problem is that your biology and your learning history is such that you haven't learned how to regulate. So DBT, dialectical behavior therapy, is rooted in that understanding that, that these are folks that struggle with the ability to soothe and regulate an overactive and dysregulated biology.
Those are our guys. 100% needed. That's individuals on the spectrum. Yep. And it's because they know a lot. It's not what they know. It's accessing what they know when they need to know it. It's about being able to regulate themselves in the environment at that exactly. moment and to access exactly. their executive functioning and to be able to tell them, you know, relax, calm down, and to have these strategies, but they can't. It gets so out of whack. And so then you're yeah. saying self-injury, you know, then also the different types of eating that you're talking about, because mm-hmm. they're trying to regulate themselves. And you said food does that, right?
Food does that. Food, self-harm. And that's one of the things I teach families and teach clients as well, to understand that every behavior has a function. Even if you don't understand it, that's because some of the behavior might be reinforced, which is what keeps the behavior going. You have to appreciate and understand, why does this behavior of binging and purging keep happening? Why does the person continue to bang their head against the wall? Like, why does this keep happening? Because you and I from the outside might go, well, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. How does that help somebody? Well, if restricting one's food intake in the short term produces a sort of numbing, an emotional numbing effect. So people don't feel as intensely emotional when they're under eating, even though it leads to a whole host of other problems. Their main focus is, I just need to get through this moment. Okay. Like, let me just get through right now. So there's a, you know, dopamine is released, et cetera, et cetera. When somebody self-harms, hugely reinforced, we've got a list of like 30 different ways that self-injury gets reinforced internally and in from the environment, right? So you have to really look at each case and understand, why does this person do this? And what do they get out of it from a biological perspective or even from the environment? So I work with lots of kids who, you know, let's say mom and dad are super busy. I remember working with this young woman. And mom was this, you know, high-powered lawyer in a major city and, you know, always busy, loved her kid like crazy, right? Like, but mom's super busy, dad's away. And my client relapsed. She had anorexia. She relapsed. So I go in to see her. She's in the hospital. She's very ill. I said, what happened? How are we back here again? And after some time, we realized that when she was so sick that she needed to be in the hospital, mom would stop working, would come to the hospital with bags full of girl stuff. They'd paint their toenails. They'd read magazines. And it was the mom she needed and wanted. And as soon as she would gain some weight and get better, mom would say, oh my God, thank goodness. And she would have to go back to work, of course. But what was happening was understanding that, what this young girl is learning is that the way to get my mom's attention and love and nurturance, I got to get really, really sick. That's not the case for everybody.
I hear you.
But yep. This is the kind of stuff that from my lens, I look for, what might be inadvertently reinforcing this behavior to keep happening?
Now, let me talk to you about a behavior. And this is my ace in the hole here, because it's the number one thing that I hear about when in terms of food. And then let's apply those same strategies that you just talked about. What are some of the first questions you're asking yourself as a clinician when you see clients hoarding food? I just can't tell you enough how much I hear that. Is that a eating disorder thing, or is that something else neurologically going on?
It depends. I mean, you really have to understand, you know, it could be, you know, people hoard food and other items with obsessive compulsive disorder and tendencies.
Right.
I have to understand what's the function of the behavior. If you're hoarding food, some people hoard food and then binge on it later. Some people hoard food out of a fear of not being able to have food in the future. So I've had some people who have grown up with food insecurity, who've been in foster homes, who grew up in environments where they didn't have enough food. And now as adults, they hoard all kinds of food. So it doesn't mean that hoarding food itself is an eating disorder. It really depends on the context and what else is going on and why they're hoarding that food and what they do with that food. Does it just sit in the basement in a closet?
So these are
the questions. Do they go and check it? Do they eat it?
Yeah. So you can.
Yeah. These are the questions.
You're asking all the questions to find out what's going on.
I am. Yeah.
Because it's just so.
But I'm also like, because. Oh yeah. No. Sorry to interrupt you. I'm also an emotion focused researcher and clinician. I'm always also looking at what is this person's emotional awareness, capacity, ability to communicate. So if I've got somebody that can't identify emotion or can't communicate effectively, already I know that they're going to have difficulty, right? To be healthy, to be able to feel grounded in yourself, you have to be able to understand what's going on inside you, and you have to be able to communicate that somehow to somebody else. So a lot of people with, you know, autism spectrum, FASD really struggle to effectively communicate. So sometimes behaviors like hoarding or not eating or overeating or whatever become actually reinforced ways of communicating something. So I'm also looking for, are you trying to tell me something that maybe you can't tell me verbally?
Right. Spot on.
You got to spend time with somebody. Yeah. And yeah.
Yeah, no, you got me. Like, absolutely. It is fascinating, and it is scary for caregivers. Now, you know, can you believe it's already 45 minutes? It goes like this.
I know. I could talk to you all afternoon.
I could ask 1,000 more questions, but we're respecting those that are on a walk right now. So they're walking, and sometimes I hear,
right,
you go over an hour and I got to do another block, lap around the block. So in essence, we're helping them become heavier. Yeah, you should hear all the ways the people listen to the podcast, because I asked them. Like, some people listen to it in the shower. Some people listen to it when, like, their kids are at school. Like, they just put their headphones on and just so they can visually watch their kids.
It's amazing.
It is really.
Yeah.
Cool. And it trends all over the world. So it's really cool. So let's keep that in mind when we're talking about interventions here. So from your professional, like, this is your life's work, what can caregivers do if their gut, and because we need them to trust their gut, they know their kid better than anybody, and some of these red flags that you've been talking about go on, what do they do?
Well, in an ideal situation, talk to somebody who ideally is familiar with eating disorders. And I understand, I mean, here we are in Ontario, we have a crisis. People are waiting 6 to 12 months to get into a program. So I understand the reality out there. However, there are, you know, first try to find somebody who has some training and expertise in eating disorders, even to get an initial consultation. That's a good place to start, because you want to know, like, what is going on? Is there an eating disorder here with my child? There are also some great nonprofit organizations like Feast, Need, NIED.ca, et cetera. There's other places that give us great information. So I encourage parents to educate themselves. One of the biggest barriers to treating an eating disorder is that people don't really understand what they are. And so they miss the signs and symptoms, or they don't trust their gut. Or a lot of times, unfortunately, medical doctors, you go to your family doctor, you go to a pediatrician or your GP, they've had less than 5 hours of any training in eating disorders on average. So often you go to your family doctor and you say, this just happened. This just happened in our clinic last week. We asked a patient to go. She went with her mom, and the doctor just said, no, there's nothing here. Even though we've assessed and diagnosed that there is an eating disorder, the family doctor wouldn't do blood work, wouldn't do lab work. And I understand, like, you know, the doctor's doing the best they can, and they're not trained in this area. You really need to get some good material related to eating disorders.
Yeah.
First and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Same as FAS. You're saying the same thing.
It's the same, right? Knowledge is power, mm-hmm. right? So you're in the dark otherwise. So you need to kind of, and now here's one of the nice things that's happened, if I can go that far with COVID.
Yeah, let's do it.
COVID has forced, let's do it, right? One of the things that COVID has done is it's forced a lot of the material that would be harder to find into the mainstream. There's so many great resources online now for caregivers around eating disorders, and, you know, podcasts like this one, you know, where people are talking about stuff, and you don't have to wait 6 to 12 months to find out, oh my gosh, that's exactly what's happening here. Nobody knew. Mm-hmm. From that point on, depending on where you are in the world, depending on if you have coverage or not, best case scenario is you work with a team that can help with eating disorders. So for example, on my team, we have registered dietitians who understand eating disorders, who have also worked with a range of neurodevelopmental conditions as well, because standard eating disorder treatments are not necessarily designed for someone with FASD. Mm-mm. You see, so I think you need to find people who have experience or expertise in both, who can guide you through eating. And then there's a number of things that we do. I don't know how much detail you want me to get into. There's just a number of things that we do. Well, there's lots of things that we do, but we have to help your kids eat. And we empower the caregivers to help the kids eat. And I know that sounds really hard to do in the face of emotion dysregulation.
Right.
And we have some really good interventions and strategies, because if they're not eating, all the other stuff they have is going to get worse. Right. Yeah,
that's fair.
So we have got to create structure and routine and safety around meals. And we have to learn skills and strategies to tolerate the distress that's going to come up when I'm asking you to eat something that is not the texture you like. And so we do a lot of graduated exposure. We work very, very carefully with people to make sure that we've developed a treatment plan that makes sense for them and their family. Right.
Yeah, and one of the things you talked about, which I love, you're speaking my language, is evidence-based practices, right? Yeah. Is like evidence-based. Now, DBT, okay? So newbie here, because I my parents have been talking about this. So as soon as I read this about you, I was like, I am going there. Like I'm five, what is DBT?
I need a whole other podcast for this one. Okay.
The best that you could do, the best we can go.
Okay.
I just think it's important. So some people are driving in their car and they're like going DBT. What? So what is it?
Okay. So DBT stands for dialectical behavior therapy. It's a evidence-based treatment designed by Marshall Linehan, you know, in the 70s and 80s. And it was originally developed for people with chronic suicidal and self-harming behavior. And the treatment was so effective at helping people with impulsive, self-destructive urges and behaviors that researchers around the world said, hey, wait a second, that might work for depression and substance use. And what about eating disorders? And what about developmental disorders? And what about, and DBT has now evolved into a gold standard evidence-based treatment for really for anybody who struggles with emotion dysregulation.
Okay. Which our guys disorder or not, our guys do. Because individuals on the spectrum and their families have a hard time finding the proper therapy because a part of the disability is cognition based, right? You have to have impairment to three of the 10 brain domains. And oftentimes they, work at a Ken FASD found that there's 7 to 9 impairment, 9 of those brain domains. Mm-hmm. That's a lot, right? So something like CBD or CBT
CBT, cognitive behavior therapy. Yeah,
when you have to look inside yourself sort of for the answers, doesn't really know work when thinking is part of the disability. How is DBT different in that respect?
So DBT, you're spot on. So cognitive models try to work with the way you think. So you have to be really, you know, prefrontal cortex. You got to be thinking, writing down thought records. You've got to really be able to engage with that kind of cognitive material. In DBT, there is still a lot of that. However, we adapt. I also want to say that DBT gets adapted for different populations. Yep. So, but in my 5-minute quick spiel about DBT, I guess I would say that it's different because DBT says, yeah, your thoughts are important. What we think is the most important driver, though, is your emotion regulation system. So everything we do in DBT, and it's very experiential, very skill-based. We teach concrete skills to the patient, but also to the caregivers. How do you tolerate distress? What if you have a huge, overwhelming tidal wave of an urge? How are you going to cope with that when your biology is such that you don't even think you can cope with it? We teach them how to identify and regulate emotion. How do you actually, on a day-to-day basis, you know, regulate yourself? Not just when you're in a crisis, day-to-day. We teach them how to be more interpersonally effective. So they're very, very concrete skills around communication. That is built from assertiveness sort of models, but we teach them with very specific scripts sometimes. Try saying this, try doing this, and it's so reinforcing. And then we focus on mindfulness. And we do it, though, in a way that is accessible for people who are emotionally dysregulated and impulsive. So this isn't, let's sit down for 45 minutes and meditate. These are these little teachable moments and nuggets of how can I get a little bit more present focused? How can I be a little bit more non-judgmental? How can I do one thing at a time? And it has a profound impact. The really powerful thing that I want to stress is that the more people do treatments like this, it actually does rewire parts of the brain. So Jeff, when we sit here and we talk about biology, I don't think that it's impossible to change some of what goes on in the brain. The brain's far more plastic than we ever imagined it to be.
Agreed. Yeah.
And so when you practice these skills,
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. It's
we're both excited about it.
Yeah, that's the problem. Dr. Jackie Pye from the University of Alberta talks about that, about like, you know, if you look at white matter as like a gravel road, well, you know, you could do some work where you can smooth the road out. You know, you won't ever be able to make it a 4-lane highway, but you can make the road better functioning by doing this stuff.
Absolutely.
This is awesome because so folks, if you're listening to this, obviously this is a 5-minute spiel on it. You want to do some more research on it, but it almost sounds like on a secondary, you're empowering people, because how long have they gone and know that they can't regulate emotionally, and now you're giving them skills? That's almost control over your life. Like, that's getting it back.
It is. That DBT has offered tremendous hope for people who have, again, been stigmatized, misunderstood, etc. And what it can do for those struggling and for their families is give them the tools, the strategies, and the way of working with this kind of complexity in a way that, like, yeah, you can package this up and take parts of this home with you. And the success of DBT across diagnoses and across populations, I mean, it's, you can't ignore it. Now, again, like for FASD, I would adapt the treatment. I mean, absolutely. DBT in its full offering is a heavy treatment. Sure. It's a big treatment. And, you know, and I think there's so much there for everybody involved.
I think so
to learn how to deal with emotion and emotion regulation.
If it's not just thinking based, if there's more to it, and with FASD, you have to adapt everything. And even within the adaptations,
right,
everybody's an individual and they need an individual plan. What works for one person with FASD won't work for another person. It may not. So that's why you really need to know who they are when you're talking about getting assessment. You even talked about you won't even finish an assessment till you get blood work. That's how individualized it gets down to.
Yeah. Because like you said at the beginning, you don't know what you're really looking at. By simply, the person shows up in your office. You can't judge how serious a condition is simply by looking at somebody. You have no idea. So I cannot develop a final treatment plan until I have their lab work and their ECG, because we have people of all different weights, shapes, and sizes who are dangerously ill, but they don't look it. And nobody thinks to ask because they're not at a weight that people would start to get concerned about.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Right? Like nobody looks at FASD and looks at the person's functioning, they react to the behaviors, when in essence the behaviors That's are right. symptoms of a neurological impairment in some of the domain.
They're secondary to what's underlying. So if you think about, again, that iceberg metaphor, what we see on the surface is just the tip of the iceberg. We're just seeing how the behavioral expression of all of what's going on genetically, biologically, how it gets manifested. But if we don't look at, well, how do we work with cognitive rigidity or inflexibility, or how do we work with sensory deficits when there's eating issues on board? How do you work with someone who says, I can't eat that, I'm too scared of the food, not because I'm afraid of gaining weight, but I don't want to eat that, and now they're losing weight? You have to be able to combine what you know to be true about working with people that have FASD, for example, and what you know to be true about eating disorders and emotion regulation. And that's what I love to do in my career is adapting and fine-tuning treatments, again, for people who often get missed.
Yeah.
Who are not seen in the way they need to be seen. And then they suffer. I don't know how many times over the years, Jeff, people have said to me, you know, we do a full assessment and I explain it back to them what I'm seeing. And they say, well, you know, I've been seeing professionals for 15 years. No one's explained it like this. I wish somebody had.
Yeah.
Part of it is we're just getting caught up. You know, some of it's just the research just coming in the last 5-10 years, you know, has changed a lot in 20 years. But I always say to people, you keep turning over stones. You've got to keep asking. You've got to keep researching. Because I've watched people who you know, other professionals have said, there's no more that can be done here. And I've watched them, you know, grow and change and respond to all kinds of new interventions. Right. So I think you got to keep going.
And you also said something is that for caregivers is to go on every waiting list, even if it seems like, but you say you don't care. You just get on there.
At this point, because first of all, it gets daunting. You know, parents call and they say, oh, Anita, it's a 6-month wait list. I put your name on the wait list. Oh, Anita, we can't wait 12. Just put your name on the wait list. One, that wait list can move faster than you think. Just because it's 12 months doesn't mean it's going to be 12 months. Second, time still moves quickly. Like even if it's 6 months, 6 months will actually go fast. And at least we've got a plan B or C or D. So, you know, it's kind of like, you know, my uncle always says, well, you know, you can't win the lottery if you never play, you know? And I say, well, it's kind of the same thing. You got to put your name in there. You got to keep put your name, call people. And I know it can be discouraging. And if you stay in it, people will get back to you. We're just also struggling out here. Like there's just so the demand for services right now is through the roof.
What you said is there's such an increase. And for us with FASD, there's an increase in aggression because all of these anchors have been removed. And especially here in Ontario, parents are getting their chains yanked. You know, we're in school, we're out of school, we're doing this. So the whole family dynamic is just blown in the wind and there's no stability, which really is the success factor for families.
But that's what I mean by sort of perfect storm, you know, all of those. I like how you said those anchors have been, you know, lifted or removed. And so we're all out there in the storm, free floating, you know, and, you know, we've got to do the best that we can with what we've got, because it's very difficult right now. And this is where I say to people, reach out, look at what's online, you know. We're always trying to post stuff to give people resources, ideas, you know, free. What's out there?
Yeah.
Where can you get information?
Now,
and I am happy to say that you can.
Now, we do have a segment here. It is, we call it, it's a self-promotion segment where we're shameless self-promotion segment. So when you talked about that, well, that's what we do. We don't care. We just go for it. Now, where can people reach you? You have a slick looking website, I will tell you.
Oh, thanks.
It is really nice. And can you give us the website? I know you're in Burlington, but you're in Midland, right?
I'm in Midland. Yeah.
So you're in Ontario. Yeah. So for the person listening to this in Hong Kong, you could still go because you have a blog. You still have information on your site, if they can't directly. Do you do? Are you only licensed in Ontario? What? Because this always happens to Anita. Yeah. Someone's gonna write me from California or from BC and say, you know, are they able to connect with your services?
So as a psychologist, yes, we are, you know, this is what happens even in the States or in different places. You are licensed by state or province. Now, COVID has given us a little more reciprocity in the sense that I can contact the state of California and say, listen, you know, we do specialized services here. There's an argument to be made. And many places around the world have been extremely gracious in letting go of those geographical boundaries. So it's not impossible, but there are a few more hoops when you're working internationally. If it's therapy, we definitely need that. If it's education, if it's training, so I train all over. I have training in Australia, training, you can do workshops and webinars and all over. That's fine. You don't need any special permission for that.
So you're going to call or you're going to go to your website. What's your website?
So it's a bit longer. So I don't know if you know, it's psychology. It's psychology-emotionregulation.ca. So, you know, if you look that up or if you look up me, you know, spelling Anita Federici is not the easiest thing.
I just like Anita Federici. Like it's got a good zip to it, buddy. But you also
do. Well, I appreciate that.
You also do mini training, like little, you have Instagram. What's your Instagram handle? That's super accessible. People can connect with you there.
Yeah. So I use my Instagram account to really post whatever the latest and greatest that I can think of or things that I wish I would have known.
Love it.
So there's that. So that's just at Dr. Anita Federici. So if you look me up on Instagram, I am there. And I really try to use the, you know, my Instagram account or my website to really give people resources, ideas, to talk to people. I love talking to people. So, you know, people send me messages and I do my best to get back to you because, you know, Jeff, as you said, some of this information is so specialized, so hard to actually access that I do my best to try to be a resource to people all over the world. And so happy to try to help in any way that I can, myself, my team, that's what we do.
Do you take any unsolicited food pics on your Instagram?
I don't.
Yeah, okay, I thought you paused there for a second. So I thought you were like, maybe I do.
No, but I really, you know, I have a in the eating disorders world, we have a non-dieting stance, you know, a health at every size, non-fat shaming, like these sorts of, you know, bodies are meant to be diverse. Eating is an important part of our regulation and our survival. And I try to model that in whatever platform that I'm in.
Here might be the most important question. Just before I leave you here, what is the last good thing you've watched either on Netflix or what's the last cool show you've streamed? What are you into right now?
I just finished watching Superstore. I don't know if you've watched Superstore. No, have you?
Like, I've seen not. I've seen a couple episodes. I'm a gamer, Anita. So, like, all my spare time is doing that. But I have seen it. So, you heard it here, folks. Dr. Anita Federici is telling you to check out and get really informed about eating disorders, but also, when you have some downtime, check out Superstore on Netflix. Anita, would you come back and do this?
I would love to come back and do this. I feel like there's so much I would love to chat with you about.
See, if we ever hooked up at a conference and started chatting, this could be a 10-hour conversation. But I appreciate you, taking a leap of faith and coming on the show and educating and taking all your time with how booked you are. I really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me and for, you know, your advocacy in this area. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. So thank you.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Listen, Dr. Anita Federici, her website should be called thebomb.com. That was a fantastic interview. She brought the goods and I think we had some chemistry. I don't know about you, team. What do you think? I do this for you. I was nervous. It's the first time I was meeting her. I checked out her bio. Maybe I got a little bio shock. What I mean by that is that you're like, whoa, look at this person. But she's still a human, and she's a pretty kick-ass at that. Okay, I want to go through just a few things, okay? Listen, I like to ask origin stories because I want to find out where the motivation comes. That's how you could tell how passionate really people are. And you know she's passionate. She's really into it because she's even came right out and said she was struggling with her own body image. And that's something she dealt with. Her family members have dealt with it as well. So she's committed, and as a therapist and as a lecturer and as a teacher that she comes from not only clinical experience but personal experience, and that is the best kind. You put those two together, bada boom, it makes you the realest person in the room for sure. I liked how she talked about, she said how COVID exasperates an already unsettled biology. So since the biology of the individual is already unsettled, people turn to maladaptive ways of coping, whether they mean to or not. Eating is one of those behaviors that can soothe an unsettled biology. Boom. Right? It's a short-term gain and long-term pain, like she was talking about. Certain eating disorders are deficits in the limbic systems and abnormalities in the actual metabolic system. So if you're like me and you don't know the big words, metabolic means relating to or deriving from the metabolism of a living organism. Thank you, Google. And then she said, people are primed to struggle with eating and feeding. So what comes naturally to people is an inability in others. So because of the abnormalities, the deficits in your limbic system, abnormalities in your metabolic system, your metabolism, she's saying people are primed to struggle with eating and feeding. So what comes naturally to you and I is an inability in others. And this is where I was like, yep, we're best friends right now. Because this isn't refusal, it's inability. They're not refusing to eat. They're not on purposely trying to be picky eaters. And what was more so, she said, Jeff, even in the clinical setting, you know, the doctors are saying, okay, enough of this. Just start eating. Just like it is, your kids aren't trying to be jerks on purpose. They're not trying to make your life a living hell. They're not trying to make everything distressful. They aren't bad. It's their inability to function and adapt as expected throughout the lifespan. It's the same thing with eating. Also, when we looked at the NIH, there's some research that says FASD is also with delayed. You know, individuals with FASD have delayed acquisition of self-feeding behavior. So I like how she talks about, you know, eating and eating disorder is the inability to feed oneself, the inability to regulate oneself. You can't have an eating disorder and be emotionally regulated. And then she's talking about how restricting your calorie intake, this fasting, like dieting, can actually impact the brain's functioning. And she just had so much good to say. And I'll leave it on this one. Every behavior has a function, even if you don't understand it. It's not willful. It's purposeful. They're trying to meet a need, and they lack skills to either acquire that need or to soothe and to regulate. But it's hard when they look normal and they talk normal and they're saying these things and they're doing these things. But this is all from the brain, and it's amazing how even food has an impact about it. So do what she says. Look for the resources online. If you have a clinic, if you suspect there could be an eating disorder, look more into it. Talk to your doctor about it, because it's so important to make sure that our kids are healthy, like physically healthy. You know, it's not just the brain, it's the whole body that is impacted and all the systems in between. That's why there's over 420 concurring disorders with this disability. And the fact that you are doing this and learning and listening to this makes you so awesome. And you will be successful, even though you might not feel like you're going to be successful and you might not ever see a way out of this, what situation you are in. The fact that you're here, the fact that you're listening, the fact that you're trying to learn and get better and be awesome, it will happen. Just keep showing up. Just keep learning. Just keep improving yourself. You know, one of my favorite quotes, I think it was Winston Churchill, when you're going through hell, just keep going. And I want you to do that. Because I know you could do that, because we're going to wait until this pandemic is over and then we could see each other and we can hang out with each other. So I'm going to assume by this time, you know, it's well over an hour, that this is the end of show crew, right? This is, you know, the post show pod squad. I don't know. We're going to have a name with it. And I'm going to build a community. And so we've been playing with a lot of ideas. And you're going to hear them in the future, because we're going to create them and we're going to release them. I just want to get to know you more. It seems like it's me on a microphone, and I want feedback from you. I want to know how we can make the show better. I want to start taking questions. We can answer them here on the show, and even give you a way to join a community where I can let you know who is coming up, and that those people that are in the community can ask me questions and I can include them in the interviews with people. It's going to be amazing. So look out for that. We're working really hard on it. Also, before I go, I have been getting multiple messages now, which are fantastic. And the messages usually go like this. Your podcast is awesome. It's helped so many aha moments. We love it. And I love hearing that. And then people say, well, how could we support the show? And before, I would just say, you could just support the show by sharing it and by listening and by telling other people about it. But people still want to go above and beyond that. So what we've done is we made it a way where if you like what we're doing, it's totally optional. You do not have to do this. But folks who feel inclined to, you could buy me a coffee. You can buy me a coffee. We have a website. It's called buymeacoffee.com/FASD success. And if you want, you could buy me a coffee to show your support. And you can even leave a message. You can leave a message there. If you have some insight for the show or some feedback, that would be a great place to let me know. I don't know if I can respond to every one of them, but I could definitely read all of them. And I definitely will do that. So if you want to buy me a coffee and support the show, you could do that. buymeacoffee.com/FASD success. Don't forget to say hi when you do. We really appreciate the support. There's a lot of things we want to do with the podcast and make it grow and make it better, so it is the, you know, continues to be the number one place and one of your favorite resources to go to, just to become a better person, a better parent, a better caregiver, to make individuals' lives on the spectrum better. And we got something cool going on here, and I freaking love you. I'm just so motivated to keep doing this. There's so many things we can do, but I also want your feedback about that. So I'm going to create community, so I'll be able to curate that and make it happen. And I love to create groups and to have people meet each other. Could you imagine get to meet other people on social media that listen to the show, and then you go, next thing you know, you're becoming buddies and everything's awesome. Okay, I'm going to let you all go. Thanks for listening. I hope you got a lot of good value out of it. Remember, keep pushing, keep grinding. You are amazing. You are the expert on your kid. Nobody knows your kid like you do. So if anybody's trying to put you down, make you feel small, make you feel disrespected, just know that I am in your corner, and I know you're doing the absolute best, and you are the absolute right person for your loved one. So until next week, we'll talk then. I love you. Bye.